A very interesting Rashi in the end of Parshas Matos, amidst a flurry of Jewish conquest. 2.5 tribes have expressed their preference to remain on the East Bank, initially irritating Moshe Rabbeinu, ultimately eliciting a contract, a bilateral agreement to advance militarily with their brothers alongside the other tribes, the other Shvatim, fight the wars and then return. And having been green-lighted and authorized, they conquer much of the land that had already been conquered from Sichon, from Og, in the wars described in earlier Parshios, are delivered to these Shvatim. And the Torah engages in a very meticulous detailing of which lands were handed over. This phenomena is in and of itself interesting. And it describes some of the naming. Part of the reason is because these were shifted names, and the shifting of names is described by the phrase Musabos Shem. Their names were designated because evidently they possessed names which were affiliated with pagan sites and pagan worship, so those names had to be altered, and this is a preview of the Jewish entry into Eretz Yisrael, an entry which is not just geographical and national, but it's theological, to empty the chosen land from paganism and heathen customs. But there's one city whose name seems to be, oddly enough, based on the leader of that tribe. This is Ya'ir ben Menashe. So this is the son of Menashe. The Ramban actually describes his genealogy. This was a person who belonged to Shevet Yehuda. He was a great-grandson of Yehuda. He was the son of Chetzron, who was the son of Peretz, who was, of course, the son of Yehuda. And his mother was the grandson of Menashe. She was the daughter of Machir, who was the son of Menashe. So Ya'ir really wasn't the son of Menashe. That would be obviously historically impossible, Menashe having died well before Yetzias Mitzrayim. But this was a man named Ya'ir, who, for whatever reason, genealogically affiliated himself with the tribe of his mother, Menashe, not the tribe of his father, Yehuda, which in the context of Matos and Benot Selefchad, which of course also pertain to the Shevet of Menashe and their worries that daughters of the tribe of Menashe would marry men from other tribes and lose their tribal affiliation and ultimately their Nachla. And there you have the inverse. You have a man of Yehuda opting in to Shevet Menashe, or at least calling himself Ya'ir ben Menashe, because his wife came from or was a granddaughter of Menashe. Either way, he is given a land, or he captures a land, and he calls the land Chavos Ya'ir, the cities, the regions of Ya'ir. He names it after himself. Now, why does he call it Chavos Ya'ir? Rashi comments, it's unclear where this comes from, but Rashi comments, sounds like it may be from Rav Moshe Hadarshan, that Ya'ir had no children. So not only was his past genealogy complex, but he was left childless. Facing that prospect of having his identity almost disappear or erase because he had no children, he named the cities Chavos Ya'ir so people would always know who he was, what his impact on Jewish history has been. So when we name a city, when we name, I know that in Eretz Yisrael today, a lot of the streets are named after Gedolim, not just here and there symbolically in Chutz Laaretz every once in a while. There's a street who has a symbolic name after a great rabbi. But in Eretz Yisrael, when we name streets after great rabbis, great Talmid Chachamim, many other cases, great Zionist heroes, soldiers, in some way we're meant to perpetuate their memory by affixing their name to geographical locations. Now, what's interesting is that this term, Chavos Ya'ir, to name, in this case, a city or a region after Ya'ir, who died childless, ironically, this name resurfaced thousands of years later in the form of a very interesting sefer that also had interesting and intriguing aspects of attribution. In the 17th century in France, there was a man, a rabbi, a great Talmud Chacham named Yair Chaim Bachrach. Lived in the early 17th century, 1638, dies in the beginning of the 18th century. And here's one of the Achronim, one of the early Achronim of Germany. And he serves as a Rav in primarily Magenza and Vermeisa. He's appointed the Rav around 1666 or even a little bit earlier. And then interestingly enough, from 1669 onwards, till around 1699, he's no longer the Rav. It's an unclear reason, but he's not voted for a second term, so to speak. And then in 1699, he has a second, very briefly, only for 2 years, because he dies in 1701, he has a second term as a Rav. One of the well-known poskim of Germany in the early Achronim period. He's noted because he was very independent-minded. He knew math, music. He wrote about Nistar, but he didn't write about it. He actually was opposed to studying Nistar. He wrote a book on astronomy from Ghazal's perspective, but then he burnt it because he was worried about its impact. So it was a very, very intriguing, odd almost, personality, a little different than the average classic personality. Very strident, very machmir in many of his positions. And he scribed 40 svarim. There are actually 40 svarim that he wrote. But the most well-known is the Sefer Chavos Yair. That's actually spelt Chei Vav Chet Vav Vav Taf Yud Aleph Yud Resh. Whereas the Chavos Yair in Parshas Matos is spelt with only one Vav. Keep in mind, his name Yair was not the original name given to him when he was born in 1638. His original name was Chaim, but he was very ill. And the minhag is, when people are ill, we try to add names that are positive sounding. Very often the name Chaim is added, but his name was already Chaim. So the name Yair was appended. He should enlighten and provide light. So Yair Chaim Bachrach. And he names his Sefer Chavos Yair after, in some ways, this phraseology in Parshas Matos, but for a very different reason. His grandmother was a very well-known woman, a very learned woman, which was very unusual in those days. She was also a poet. She composed Jewish piyutim, and she was a granddaughter of the Maharal Prague, and she raised him. And she was always looking after him. And he was so well known as her grandson that in Yiddish, when people would refer to him, perhaps as a child, they would say, oh, that boy, the name of his grandmother was Chava. So they would say, oh, that's Chava's Yair. Thus is Chavos Yair. Chavos in Yiddish is the possessive. Chava's, as we would say in English. Thus is Chavos Yair. And he named the Sefer after his grandmother. And as best as I can tell, there aren't too many svarim named after grandparents. Most svarim carry the name of the author. Some svarim, maybe Cheskel Landau, well-known chief rabbi of Prague, early 18th century. Two most famous svarim, Noda Behuda after his father, Tzion LeNefesh Chaya, the Tzlach after his mother who died at an early age. But this is a sefer named after a grandparent. And, so to speak, the name, which is Hebrew, and of course is almost identical to Chavos Yair in Parshas Matos, carries a Yiddish inflection because he was always identified as his grandmother. So if Yair ben Menashe, who himself had a very strange tribal affiliation, names the city on the east bank Chavot Yair, Chavos Yair, because he doesn't have children, thousands of years later in the 17th century, Yair Chaim Bachrach, a German rabbi, names his most prominent sefer after his grandmother, but arrives at the very same name. So the same name has arrived, two different languages, very, very different genealogical conditions, and they happen to arrive at the very same name. One more Rashi I wanted to speak about carries an implicit, quiet critique of these 2.5 tribes. Of course, one can't help but read this story in the backdrop of the Meraglim. Once again, the Jews are primed to enter Eretz Yisrael. Once again, there's a group of people who balk and who question, and Moshe himself connects the dots, and he's furious. But there's a second level of critique, and perhaps that level highlights a very different basis for their rejection or even scorning of the opportunity to enter Eretz Yisrael. After Moshe's initial rage, they come with a counteroffer. Vayikshu elav vayamru, this is in Pasuk Tezayin, Gidrotzon nivneh l'mekneinu po, we will build homestead for our cattle, ve'arim l'tapeinu, and cities for our children, and then we'll go ahead and battle, advance, lead the Jewish people, and return to our homestead after Eretz Yisrael has been conquered. Moshe essentially accepts their offer. He incorporates it into a contract, replete with conditions, and this serves as the template for all halacha conditions known fondly in the Torah world as Tanai b'nei Gad u'b'nei Ruvain. For a stipulation to be contractually valid, it has to meet the standards that Moshe stipulated in his conditional contract with the 2.5 tribes, with the 2.5 Shvatim. But Moshe says, and this is Pasuk Chaf Dalet, you'll have that right, and if indeed you elect to advance militarily, then Moshe says, Benu lachem arim, go ahead right now, build your cities, build your homesteads. But he shifts the order, as Rashi says. They had proceeded, they had originally spoken about building homesteads for cattle and homes and cities for children. Moshe switches the order. First he speaks about children, then he speaks about cattle. And Rashi, at the first pasuk, already notes an almost quiet critique. Rashi writes, Pasuk Tezayin, Chasim hayu, and he's quoting the Medrash, Al Mimonam Yosem Ibinehem Uvnosehem. They were more worried about their property than their children, Shekedimu Miknehem Letapam, because the first issue that they raised was homesteads for the cattle. Amar Le Moshe, Moshe intentionally switches the order, Lo Kein, Asuha Ikar Ikar Vatafel Tafel. Make sure you keep your priorities correct. Benu Lachem Tchila Arin Letapchem, Ve'acharkach Gidros Litzon Achem. What's intriguing is what connection, if any, exists between this moral failure, which probably is based on greed, probably is based on seeing potential for profit, seeing the rich, fertile pasture land, as we would say, seeing dollar signs, and their ideological, perhaps, say scorning is too harsh a word, but their disinterest, or lesser interest in Eretz Yisrael. Presumably, we would think the two are completely unrelated, completely independent. One is a moral flaw, greed, and greed entices them, confuses them to prioritize money, profit, over family. And the second issue is how deeply you believe in Eretz Yisrael, how much you're willing to challenge yourself to believe in HaKadosh Baruch Hu's mission, selection, promise. They seem to be two completely different challenges. But evidently, there has to be some relationship or linkage. Moshe isn't just critiquing them, by the way, you happen to be erring and you happen to be dismissive of Eretz Yisrael, but in addition, I'm concerned about the fitness of your moral position. Evidently, there's some connection between the two. And I think that is bidirectional. I think their greed makes them less attracted to the challenge but vision of Eretz Yisrael. And reciprocally, their lesser interest in the mission of Eretz Yisrael makes them or renders them more vulnerable to greed. Namely, part of the way that we deal with greed is by becoming ideological and by recognizing the value of living a life of ideas, the value of living a life of conviction, of commitment, and of sacrifice. And that should, in some way, limit our avarition and limit our avarice and limit our greed and our interest in acquiring unnecessary, extraneous, monetary possessions. And presumably there's an ideological failing that renders them vulnerable, or at least more interested in possessions. And had they been more interested in Eretz Yisrael, that would have somehow quenched their appetite or limited the appetite and helped them properly order or sequence children before cattle. So they're slipping from, or they're wavering from ideology and principle renders them more susceptible to greed. And of course, every relationship is bidirectional. And if morally a person can tackle his temptation for greed and render himself more selfless, more concerned with values beyond his own here and now and his own comfort, part of those values will ultimately be historical value of serving country, serving land, serving people. So it's not incidental that people who are perhaps limited in their heroism and commitment to the land of Israel also demonstrate a certain degree of greed. Baruch Hashem, today in Eretz Yisrael, the financial conditions, by and large, are quite comfortable for many people who make Aliyah. Many people, there are certainly sufficient challenges in relocating to Eretz Yisrael, but in most cases, the finances are not the primary challenge. People can live here comfortably. But working back 30 years ago, and certainly 50 years ago, the challenges in moving to Eretz Yisrael financially were quite stiff, and many people were deterred. Those who did choose to move to Eretz Yisrael, in part it took overcoming, not even greed in a toxic or noxious sense, but overcoming some of the comforts of Gidros Tzon, of pasture land and comfort. And for some people, it was the ideology of Eretz Yisrael that they were so passionate about that created that stirring that allowed them to suppress greed or concern for financial wealth and comfort. And for some people, perhaps the process was reversed, that they were able morally to be satisfied with less. And one of the benefits, not the only benefit, of that moral journey was the ability to move to Eretz Yisrael without the concern or the price, so to speak, being felt so heavily. So it's an interesting linkage between two traits. Rashi doesn't create the linkage, but evidently, by quoting this critique of Moshe, Rashi, quoting Chazal, is trying to draw our attention to the interplay between the two. Shabbat Shalom.